Now back on the record, this is the Senate Resources Committee. It's about 3:35 p.m. on Friday, March 19, 2010. Present for the record are Senators French, Wagner, and myself, Wilikowski. Yesterday, March 18, 2010, we recessed to the call of the chair. Our original intent was to bring the committee back for a presentation on gas to liquids by Dr. Paul Metz. Co-Chair McGuire and I have decided to roll Mr. Metz's presentation to the top of Monday's agenda. So with that, the Senate Resources Committee is adjourned. This is a joint Senate Resources and House Fisheries Committee meeting. The time is about 3:37 p.m. Today's date is March 19, 2010. Present for the record are Senators Wagner, French, myself, Wilikowski, Chairman of the Fisheries Committee, Bryce Edgman, Representative Millett, and Representative Munoz.
Osterman in the back there too.
And we also have Representative Osterman in the back. There's been a lot of back and forth about the Pebble prospect. Today we want to take a step back and focus on the state regulations and statutes that will guide state agencies when they ultimately review available data and make permitting decisions. At its December 2009 meeting, the Alaska Board of Fisheries heard a lot of concerns from members of the public, particularly residents of the Bristol Bay region, that the standards guiding permitting agencies are not adequate to ensure that the mine will only be developed if the fisheries can be protected. After hearing this testimony, the Board of Fisheries wrote a letter to the legislature in January 2010. This letter asks us to, quote, conduct a comprehensive evaluation of the permitting protections and standards, including regulations and statutes which provide safeguards against environmental damage, end quote. They further ask that, quote, after such evaluation, the legislature enact any additional safeguards which are considered prudent to provide strict protections to the fish and game habitat of the drainages to prevent any chance of environmental damage, end quote. Many Alaskans are asking for assurances that our statutes, regulations, and permitting capacity are adequate to ensure that the mine will only be permitted if it can adequately protect Bristol Bay's fisheries. This is what everyone involved wants, from the Board of Fisheries to the citizens of Alaska to the Pebble Partnership. Today I'd like to hear from our panelists whether and why we should be concerned enough about this mine in this place to embark on such an analysis. The questions we have given to each of the panelists will give us a preliminary sense of what we may wish to do in response to the request from the Board of Fisheries. Before we begin, I'd like to give Representative Edgman, Chair of the House Fisheries Committee, an opportunity to make some opening remarks. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Chairman Wilikowski. I think there's no question that the Pebble Mine, on the face of it, is extremely controversial. And the region itself out in Bristol Bay, through a number of surveys, name any reputable poster in the state of Alaska, has time and time again demonstrated its severe concern about the prospect of the mine going in place right next to the last great sockeye salmon fishery, and not just North America, but in all of the world. I think that the hearing today, where we gathering the lead permitting agency, the Department of Natural Resources, respected member of the scientific community with background in the industry itself, a former member of the Senate, Senate President Rick Helford, and also the Pebble Partnership, to have that well-rounded conversation in terms of the strengths and weaknesses, the pros and cons of the existing system, and to really ask ourselves that very difficult question: is the Pebble Mine so much larger in size and scope and in magnitude, so much larger and more significant than the other mines that Alaska has throughout the state? And given its proximity right next to the very valuable fishery out in the Bristol Bay watershed, is it time to bring in a third-party assessment, to have the National Research Council to come in and take a comprehensive, multidisciplinary look to measure all the cumulative impacts from, you know, basically all aspects of what the mine might mean in terms of the environmental impact, the socioeconomic impact, the demographics, and what it's going to mean to have this huge project placed out in a region that really has been known for its renewable resources. Most recently celebrating its 125th anniversary as the, you know, the greatest sockeye salmon fishery on the planet Earth. I would very much forward, Mr. Chairman, look forward to having this conversation today. And I guess I would also add that I was at the Board of Fisheries discussion this past December, And not too long after that, the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, after 3 years of sort of intense debate on whether or not the corporation itself should maintain a neutral stance, sort of reluctantly, I guess, if you will, came out in opposition to the mine. So I think the concern is warranted. I think that we're justified in having this conversation today. And I hope that at the end of the meeting, Mr. Chairman, that we have more insight into whether or not that this project is much more significant than most of us imagine, and that it's time to bring in an outside entity to actually study its ramifications.
Thank you, Chairman Edgemond. We'll have four panelists today who will call forward in the following order. First, we'll hear from Mr. Ed Fogels, the Director of the Office of Project Management and Permitting at the Department of Natural Resources. Then we will hear from Dr. David Chambers, the President of the Center for Science and Public Participation. After that, we'll hear from Mr. John Shively, CEO of the Pebble Partnership. Following that, we'll hear from former Senate President Rick Halford. Because we'll have four panelists, we'll extend our meeting time to 5:30 today. However, our time here today is very limited, so I'll keep a strict watch on the time we spend with each panelist. We've allotted 10 minutes for each panelist to respond to four questions that I've posed to them. And if you don't have a list of the questions, we have copies outside. Those questions for the members are in your packets and are available to the public. I would ask the panelists to remain focused on the questions and to answer them in sequential order, if possible. Following each panelist's initial answers, there will be 10 minutes for questions for that particular panelist. We have previously received overviews from DNR about their large mine permitting process, from the Pebble Partnership about the studies they are undertaking, and from local residents about their concerns. I just want to reiterate, the purpose of today's meeting is not to cover that ground again, but to attend to the specific questions that we've asked. And so with that, I'll now call Director Fogels forward. Please state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ed Fogels. I'm the Director of the Office of Project Management and Permitting within the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. And just as a quick background, my office is responsible for coordinating state permitting activities for large resource development projects, including mining. We actually have no regulatory authority on our own. We just get all the other agencies together and coordinate those agencies. So I guess I'll begin. I'll go ahead and read the question, I guess, in its entirety before I begin, if that's all right. Question number one is, you are very familiar with the environmental setting and the value of fish and wildlife of Bristol Bay to Alaskans. You are also familiar with the ore body size, the minerals to be mined, the water appropriations applied for, and the size of the tailings dams that have been discussed for the Pebble Prospect. What are the biggest risks, in your opinion, of this mine in this setting? I'd like to start by saying, yes, that I am familiar with the ore deposit, the general nature of the deposit, and I am familiar with the location, the setting, the value of the Bristol Bay fisheries. I'm also familiar with the water appropriations permits that have been submitted several years ago by the Pebble Partnership. However, I am not familiar with the details of the project. I'm not familiar with the size of the dams. I'm not familiar with the exact amount of water that they're going to be using. Those are details that we'll get when they actually apply for the project, and we have not received any permit applications to the state. So I think everyone needs to understand that there's a level of detail that we don't have. And it is all about the details. The details, such as the geochemistry of the waste rock products, those drive water quality for us. And to answer the question, in my view, the biggest risks are with water quality. And the water quality is driven by what the geochemistry is of the tailings and of the waste rock facilities. And those drive how that's designed and how they're engineered. And until we get those details, it's very hard for us to specifically evaluate those risks. We have to understand how the water is going to be managed. There's a tremendous amount of water involved in the project. There's some dewatering, whether it's from underground workings or the big pit. Where are they going to put the water? We need to understand how they're going to treat the water. We have to approve those treatment systems to make sure they actually work. And we have to understand and approve the monitoring net around the project to make sure that the environmental systems are adequately monitored. So, yes, that's my response to the question number one. It's the risk to us is it's all about water quality, and that drives most of what we do. Go on to question number two. How would you compare the Pebble prospect to the scale, character, and setting of other sulfide ore body mines in the U.S. and Alaska, and what are the key lessons learned from these other mines? We know the Pebble prospect is one of the largest such ore deposits in the world. We know it's a class of ore deposit that has been studied a lot in other parts of the world. It's been mined in other parts of the world. We also know it's in a unique setting. It's in Bristol Bay, one of the world's most valuable fisheries. Again, there's a lot we don't know about the deposit that we're still going to, we expect to get that information, and before we can start looking and evaluating those risks, we need that additional information, and we will have to have that before we can adequately start reviewing permits. But we have seen enough to know that there is likely to be some acid-generating waste material in the rock type, which will have to be watched, treated, characterized, and stored appropriately. And that's probably going to be the biggest focus of a review, if we ever get to the review stage. Now, what lessons have we learned from other sulfide and similar mines around the world? I would say that the biggest single lesson that we have learned as regulators, and not just Alaska, but probably everywhere, in the last couple of decades, we've learned that we must pay attention, careful attention, to the geochemistry of the rock types. As I mentioned before, that drives water quality. We need to understand that, and there's been a tremendous leap in science, in effort, over the last 20 years in understanding that. There's still a ways to go, but we have made great strides. We can now predict long-term water quality off of these waste products with much greater certainty than we did, say, 20 years ago. We now understand that it's actually a problem. Again, the geochemistry will determine how the mine is designed. We've also learned that we need to tighten up a monitoring net around a mine, and that means the monitoring wells to monitor groundwater, surface water monitoring sites, and even beyond water quality, air biomonitoring for fish. I mean, the monitoring net around a project now is way tighter than it was years ago based on lessons learned from past mine experiences. Here in Alaska, a lesson that we've learned is we now do environmental audits on mines. And every 5 years at a minimum, we do a complete environmental audit of the project. A third-party group comes in, checks the mine, and checks the agencies to make sure that we're doing our jobs.
Just the beep went off. You actually still have 5 more minutes. So
Okay. That's response to question number 2.
You're right on time.
Question number 3. What areas of Alaska statutes and regulations do you think are most important for an analysis to focus on, given the issues you see with the Pebble prospect and the possible impacts it could have on Bristol Bay fisheries? I guess first I need to respond that it's not all about Alaska's statutes and regulations. There are federal statutes and regulations also, and in some instances, those are even more dominant for the process than the state authorities. For example, right now the EPA administers the Clean Water Act. They are responsible for issuing permits to limit the amounts of pollutants discharged by various discharges. Even when Alaska gets primacy over this program later this year, the EPA will have oversight over that program. Any waste product deposited in wetland, which is almost anywhere in Alaska, needs a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers. That's a dominant permit. Without that, the project cannot proceed. On the state side, I'm going to go through some of these very quickly. You've seen my PowerPoint, and I won't go into regulatory sites. We can provide all that to you if you need it. But again, starting with DEC, again, they're going to eventually wind up with the Clean Water Discharge Program, and they'll have to administer that. Most importantly, perhaps, is their Integrated Waste Management Program, which approves the waste product placement, the tailings dams, the waste rock piles, and ensures that those have to protect water quality. DEC also certifies stormwater permits, especially during construction. They have to certify and bless the Corps' wetlands permit also. DNR has its reclamation plan. Reclamation is key that drives water quality for the most part after closure. DNR also approves financial assurances to make sure that the money mechanism is in place to take care of the property should the operator not be able to do so. DNR also has to approve the dam designs. Those have to be shown to be stable and function as designed for as long as they exist. And then Fish and Game also has to approve any work in fish-bearing waters. So that's a brief overview of the state statutory authorities that apply to water quality that are the most important Again, we can give you more detail if you need it. Question number four, do you support choosing the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences to conduct an evaluation of the adequacy of Alaska statutes, regulations, and permitting capacity to ensure the mine can be developed while protecting Bristol Bay fisheries? And why shouldn't the legislature carry it out on its own? Why not an Alaskan research group such as the McDowell Group or ICER? Well, I'm going to answer that question in this way. We have a good mine permitting process right now. You can see proof of this with our operating mines, Red Dog, Pogo, Greens Creek, Fort Knox. We have monitoring data from them. Fish and Game has been looking at the fish populations downstream of each of these mines. All those reports are out on the web for the world to see. We believe we've been doing a good job in Alaska to date. Is our process perfect? Probably not. We can always improve. If someone wants to study our process, we would welcome the opportunity to find out ways that we can improve our process. There's no question about that. If you choose to embark on a study, there are a couple of things that we want to bring your attention to make sure that you consider in embarking on this study. If you're going to study the state's large mine permitting process, we just are concerned about what's going to happen in the interim while the study is going on. Does this mean that we have to now stop permitting until the study is complete and we get the green light again? It's just something to consider. That's a concern that's out there. In addition, if we do a study for the Pebble project, I mean, I know everyone says Pebble's in a class of its own and it's a different beast, but you know, the consideration is there. Will we now be required to do a similar study for every other mining project in the state, or perhaps every other resource development project in the state? So that's just another consideration that that I believe has to be taken into account in discussing a study. You know, bottom line is, again, we welcome ways to improve our process. A question that is asked of a group such as the National Academy needs to be carefully thought out. Above all, I really would hope that whatever the study is, that it helps us do our work, not just in Pebble, but in other parts of the state as well.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Mr. Fogles? Yes, Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Chairman Wilkowski. So, Ed, what I heard you say is that the permitting process that's in place today is adequate to safeguard the Bristol Bay fisheries in perpetuity. Is that, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but essentially that's what you just articulated to the committee?
I believe that that our permitting process can do a good job of permitting a project such as Pebble and running through the process and making the determinations as to whether that project should be permitted or not. Now, keep in mind that the decisions are made on many levels, from federal agencies to state agencies, and the process is not a static process that's the same for every project. It grows with the project. So the way that the process will change in the Pebble project is it's going to take a lot more staff and resources to go through the documentation and to work it out. And assuming we have adequate resources for the job, I believe we can do an adequate job of making the decisions for the Pebble project under the current permitting system.
I follow, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, please.
Well, I think you know the range between good enough and no net loss, I think, is where a lot of the concern arises out in the region. I think there's mounting evidence about the sensitive nature of salmon habitat and about the homing instincts of salmon returning back to their anadromous streams. And certainly there is going to be some salmon habitat destroyed within the development of the mine. And I think there's a lot of concern that maybe good enough isn't good enough. Yeah, and so, for the record, once again, the department has some reservations about having this outside multidisciplinary review of the project, because the Pebble project is similar to other large mines in the state of Alaska, or that we don't want to encumber other projects. Or, I mean, isn't there some difference between the Pebble mine next to the Bristol Bay watershed and the fisheries than Fort Knox, where it's located, Pogo mine, Rock Creek, I'm a Nome, certainly Red Dog, where it's located, Kensington, not too far from Juneau? There's got to be substantial enough difference that the department would think that this outside study would have some merit.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I'm not, I didn't intend to say that it wouldn't have any merit. I think I explained our reservations about having a study done. Beyond that, I mean, I don't think it's my place to recommend that a study be done on our own process, but as far as having reservations, I mean, I don't think that any of us have any reservations other than the ones that I told the committee about earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay, Senator French.
Mr. Fogles, you mentioned what one of the biggest concerns is with acid-generating waste material. Could you elaborate on that a little bit, give us some idea of what that material is for folks listening, what the volume you expect, what concentration, and so forth?
Well, I can give you some general information on that, but again, as far as concentrations and volumes, those are the details that we have yet to get. But Senator French, through the chair, basically, all mines, all mineral deposits out there have a different chemical makeup, and the two aspects of a particular mineral deposit that are of concern to us is there are some minerals called sulfide minerals that are some of the bad actors in some of the waste rock materials, and what can happen there is as the rock is broken up or exposed to the oxygen and water, the water will percolate through and become acidic and pick up heavy metals. And that those can leach into the environment if not taken care of appropriately. Some mines have very benign waste materials that are of very little concern. Fort Knox is sort of an example of a mine on that end of the spectrum, relatively clean rock. Red Dog is one that is very highly mineralized, and waste rock products from there are very prone to generating acidic water, heavy in metals.
And where, you know, between benign and highly acidic, do the core samples of this mine fall, if you know?
We don't know in great enough detail to make a big judgment. We know that they're in between somewhere, and not really close to the Red Dog end of the spectrum, but they're probably not really close to the Fort Knox spectrum anyway. So I would sort of, at this point, my guess is they're somewhere kind of more in the middle zone. I mean, there will be materials, as we see it now, there will be materials that will have to be carefully handled and managed. There's no question in our minds. So, but as to how they're handled, where they're disposed of, I mean, that's the big question that we don't have an answer to yet. We don't have a proposal for.
Thank you.
Senator Wagner.
So take these, basically you're going to have some suspended metals in water and in processed material that you're going to have to dispose of. So that's the reason for the dams and the containment. So how long does it take, say, a water setting over the tailings, how long does it take for that process for the settlement of the chemicals and the minerals down into a base that will solidify?
Senator Wagner, through the chairs, that is, and the answer to that question will be different for every particular mine, and again, those are the kinds of questions we're not even close to beginning to answer for the Pebble project itself. But in general, for example, up at the Red Dog mine, you have very reactive tailings with a water cap on them, and a very classic way to dispose of tailings is behind a dam with a water cap. The water keeps the oxygen from getting down into the tailings. Now, in some mines, you may need to have a facility where that water cap is maintained in perpetuity. Depending on the chemistry of everything, in some instances, maybe that water will clear up and won't be that bad, but you still want to keep the water on there. In other projects, you know, maybe that water doesn't clear up that well over the years. It really all depends on the project, and these are all the things that have to be modeled out in the application, and it will be addressed in the environmental impact study. So, you know, in an ideal project, you would figure out a way to neutralize everything so that it's benign after a certain amount of time, and you can walk away from it, and there needs to be no maintenance and no treatment whatsoever.
Thank you.
still have another 5 minutes if anyone has additional questions. Yes, Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you. Further on down the road, assuming that the organization continues to go forward with the permit, can you require this type of study as a condition of your the permits required of your department?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, just to clarify, do you mean a National Academy study?
Yes.
I mean that's a good question. I'm not sure that we would have the regulatory authority to actually require it. I'd have to look into that. I don't have a clear answer at this point for you at that. I mean, we can require, I mean, what we typically do is we require the studies up front to demonstrate to us that, the company has to demonstrate to us that they've evaluated the chemistry of the materials appropriately. However they do that, that's their first shot. We will typically, and almost always now, hire our own third-party experts. And they're typically world-famous geochemists that will come in and cross-check and look at the company's information, and will back up our read on it, or maybe just do it all for us. I mean, there's nothing to say that we couldn't ourselves go out and hire the National Academy to do that for us. I mean, it's all about funding, and money, how much it costs to hire these people to do that.
Thank you.
Representative Millett.
In a mine of, I guess we won't be able to say a mine of this size, but in normal mining processes, when do you have the appropriate geochemistry to know, and do you need to plan a development with the geochemistry to go forward with the permitting process and the evaluation that you have? I mean, how far are we into this process at this mm-hmm. point in time?
Representative Millett, through the chairs, in a normal mining permitting process, we would get that geochemistry about at the same time as we would get the permit applications. Typically, we like to see it all come in the door at once, and it's a lot of information. It'll be a detailed design of the project, of how they're going to mine, how they're going to access it, how they're going to dispose of the wastes. It'll have backup data. It'll have all the baseline data that they've collected over the last 5 years, and it'll have probably binders, many feet thick of geochemistry data, and it will all come in at that time. We assume that they've pretty much have that all together or close, in some form close, but it takes an awful lot of work on anyone's time to get that information in a form that's presentable to state agencies.
And so with that in mind, what is your department doing to ramp up its ability to take and digest all that information and get to a position where you know what the geochemistry is? I mean, how long will it take you to process all that information?
Mm-hmm. Representative Millett, through the chair. It's a little difficult because we don't know exactly when the company is going to come in with these applications. I can tell you, when we get, if we get the Pebble applications, I will need to assign a full-time coordinator position just to Pebble. I'm positive of that. Right now I have two mining coordinators that work for me, Tom Gravert and Jack DeMarkey, and they have every mine in the state split between them pretty much, right? And Pebble will be a full-time load for just one of my staff. Now that doesn't include all the staff from Fish and Game, from the other divisions of DNR, from DEC. Everyone will have to ramp up at that time. Now the budget mechanism to do that is through the reimbursable agreement through the company. So the company's agreed to pay those costs. So in some respects, the money will be there. The issue is just going to be to have the PCNs in place where you can fill them. I have two PCNs that I'm trying to fill that I can, so I can start ramping up. But again, there's a bit of a risk because if these projects never materialize, then I've hired someone and they have nothing to do. They have no funding, and I'll have to let that position go. So there's a bit of a difficult choice there to ramp up. But theoretically, we do have the fiscal ability to ramp up at fairly short notice, and we also have the fiscal ability to hire third-party contractors pretty much right away, immediately.
Follow up.
Thank you. And the level of expertise, that person, the coordinator that you're going to have to hire, is that readily available in the mining arena right now? You could go out and hire someone that was capable, highly capable, to take that function on of a mine this size?
it is not easy finding good qualified people that want to work with the state these days. Representative Millett, through the chair. I mean, there are people out there that have expressed interest. Traditionally, a mining coordinator position for the state is a high-level position. They must have a very good working knowledge of the mining industry. They must also have a very good working knowledge of government, not only state government, but the federal government. So, and for the most part, people that have that level of knowledge are, you know, often the private sector making, you know, triple what the state can pay. But I've been lucky so far. I've hired some really good people, and I hope to be lucky again.
I'd like to welcome Representative Book and Mr. Folos. Thank you very much for coming back and testifying before us. Appreciate the information.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, next up, we have Dr. David Chambers, President of the Center for Science in Public Participation. Dr. Chambers, welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record and give us your testimony. You'll have 10 minutes, and then we may have 10 minutes for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is David Chambers, and as was mentioned, I work for the Center for Science and Public Participation, which is a nonprofit. And we provide technical advice mainly to public interest groups and tribal governments on the environmental impacts of mining. I'm a geophysicist by training. I spent 15 years working as an exploration geophysicist in the industry, and for almost the last 20 years now, I've done this type of work. Your first question has to do with risks. I like to describe looking at a mine using some terminology from the business world, and that is triple bottom line. You know, there's economic considerations, there's environmental considerations, and there are social considerations. When you look at the economics, you're looking almost entirely at benefits there. And a mine like this has huge benefits. We're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars of revenue from a mine like this. When you look at environmental side of things, it's almost always a risk analysis. Very few environmental benefits from a development like this, but you need to look carefully at the risks. Social can go either way. You typically have benefits, and you also have risks and impacts on the social side. So my area of expertise is environmental. What are the environmental risks with a mine like this? I think they center around water. They center around aquatic organisms because those risks are most prominent for aquatic organisms. They're much more sensitive than, say, humans are to low concentrations of metals. And in this particular case, I think at this mine, we've already discussed a little bit about acid mine drainage and that is a risk, and I would agree that that's a risk at this particular kind of mine. And also, a key consideration here needs to be hydrology. That is, where does this mine sit, and where are contaminants liable to move from this particular location? And this particular location poses some very significant issues, and some of them are rather unique. Scale of the mine is important. This is question number two. This is a big mine, and scale is important because it makes analysis of these risks much more complicated, and it also means that usually a wider area of expertise is needed to evaluate those. I can give you a little visual demonstration of how big this mine is. Behind you, if I can get it into a full screen view for you here. So a little tough to see, but here we have a pie chart, and this pie chart would represent the total tons of ore that are available from all the hard rock mines in Alaska, and those mines are listed on the right, Pebble, Fort Knox, Red Dog, Donlin, Pogo, Greens Creek, and Kensington. And the red wedge is...
I think we have a laser pointer there if you want to use that. just please don't hit me in the eyes.
The red wedge up there is the Fort Knox mine, and the Donlin mine, which is still a proposed mine, not actually in operation, it would be the blue wedge, and the other colors of the other mines, and the rest of that circle would be pebble. So it's a big mine. There are some of the statistics that I used to generate that chart, and I would just like to add that talking in terms of how big this mine is, the last mine there, which is not on the pie chart, is called the Bingham Canyon Mine, which is the largest copper mine, actually the largest mine in the United States, in North America, and that's roughly one-third the size of Pebble, based on the amount of ore. If you take the mine that was outlined in the 2006 water rights permit applications and lay that mine out on Anchorage, that's what it would look like. They were talking in terms of 2.5 billion tons of ore at that point in time. If you take that and to the present resource that they've outlined in press releases in February of this year, that's what it would look like. So, you know, even though they're cartoons, they're based on calculations. This is not just pure graphics. One of the other considerations, of course, is long-term safety, and dam safety is one of the things that I work on. Those dams have to be designed for perpetuity. Once you put tailings and impound this waste behind it, it's got to stand there forever. So you've got to be very careful with how you design these dams. And just to show you how big a dam might be out there, again, this is from the partnership's proposal. That's how big it would be if you put it on Elliott Bay in Seattle. So we're dealing with significant scales here. Lessons learned. Very interesting study that's been done looking at this type of mine being a mine with sulfide mineralization, a mine that is close to groundwater and close to surface water. And actually, there's lots of each out there. And if you look historically being, say, from the late mid-70s when we started doing environmental impact statements on mines, if you look at how well we did at predicting what the water quality impacts would be from a mine like this, and both in terms of whether there would be metals generated and whether we could control them with mitigation measures like tailings dams, 75% of the cases were wrong. And that's not a very good batting average. And while I would agree with Mr. Fogles that we've made some significant gains over the past couple decades in trying to predict what those impacts would be and how to mitigate them, we're not doing very well. And I think we've still got, unfortunately, a lot to learn, not because there aren't a lot of bright people working on this, but just because it's a very complicated issue. Alaska statutes and regulations, I think there's some definite room for improvement there. If I were king, could I tell you how to do this right? Unfortunately, I don't think so. Again, it's a very complicated issue, and I certainly don't have all the answers. But in doing the work that I do, I also have an opportunity to see some of the flaws that are there. And just from a technical side, for instance, access to information is lacking in the present process. As Mr. Fogel said, we haven't really seen much of the detail. The company hasn't released any significant information since 2004. They collect all the information. They analyze all the information. I think it's better to, especially with a complicated project like this, to do that in a much more open and peer review environment rather than having an interested party do all that collection and analysis. And again, I worked in the industry. I have been on the other side of that, so I have a bit of a feeling for how that works. I think, again, in terms of Alaska, there are issues, for instance, with dam safety that need to be improved, can be improved relatively easily, but need to be improved. I could be glad to provide you more details on that. I think the issue of having DNR driving the permit review process poses a fundamental problem in conflict of interest, in that on the one hand, they're charged at responsibly developing mineral resources. But how does that balance against, say, fisheries resources or subsistence resources? In some areas of natural resource development in the state of Alaska, the responsible officials have to issue a best interest finding. Mining is exempted from that. And I think that's a fundamental problem. I think there should be a best interest finding associated with mining. And then finally, is it a good idea to use the National Academy of Sciences to evaluate this process? I think that is a good idea. I think I would like to see somebody with the NAS's qualifications, and why them. I think two fundamental reasons. One, they obviously can bring a lot of expertise to the table. And two, they don't have a dog in this fight, and anybody in the state, this is a big deal. And so anybody from the state is liable to suffer some collateral impact. So it's good to bring somebody in from the outside. But having said that, I would certainly welcome a similar review by somebody like ICER. I think there's some things that are obviously unique to the state that should be looked at from a state perspective. So I'd say let's do them both. And I will also say, you know, let's not only look at the regulatory process, but let's look at the mine too. Because of the scale of this thing, and because of the potential magnitude of the risks that it poses, it's a tough issue. So I would do both. I'd look at them in tandem. And I think that maybe gets to Mr. Fogel's, some of his concern about, well, did we stop the permitting process? This could be part of it. So with that, I think I'll conclude. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Chambers. Questions? Yes, Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate you coming forward. I hope this is the appropriate place, but I'm going to take a stab. I had the opportunity a couple of years ago to go out there, and I, in conversations with various people, discovered that there was some specific hydrology testing going on. Had the opportunity to talk to the scientists that were out there, and they told me that what they did is they had specific water wells. They would take samples during certain times of the year at specific depths, send those samples off to two parties, one in Seattle, one in Oregon, in order to obtain third-party verification of those analyses. I don't know what empirical protocol is. I'm going to ask you if you do, and if you could comment on that.
Yeah, I think what you're referring to is testing of samples from those wells, and what they're doing, I think, is fairly standard, and I don't have any problem with that. When I talk about concerns for hydrology, it's more for where the water moves and how fast it moves than it is present water quality, which of course is all you can measure right now. And you know, basically the water quality out there is fairly good. This is a sulfide ore body, so if you drill down into that, you're going to see some contaminants that have been mobilized. But in order to try to predict what's going to happen when you build a tailings pond on top of this material, a lot of which is very porous, you need to have drill log information about the material that you've drill through, and then some information about flows, and that information is not available to us. And in addition, that's just the starting point. Then you've got to model that, and we sort of get into the whole issue of, you know, how good is modeling, and how well are we able to predict what's going to happen. And then finally, again, this particular mine, we know it's going to be mining rocks that are potentially acid generating. In many mines today, what's done when you have that kind of problematic material, you would want to, say, line a tailings pond. But this one isn't going to be lined. I don't think that's terribly surprising because it's going to be very big, as I showed you in those slides, and it's very expensive to do that. But again, that just presents some more potential problems.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
My question actually is directed towards whether or not this would be considered an adequate baseline study. I mean, you have to start somewhere, and this seems to me one of the most enhanced and advanced hydrology baseline studies ever conducted in the state. Am I wrong, or, you know, I'm just asking.
I suspect it is the most extensive. Is it adequate? That question can't be answered because we're not seeing the results. And part of the problem in not seeing the results is if you have some preliminary feedback, you can at least make some suggestions about, well, you know, could you do, you're doing X, could you do Y also? But we can't get there.
Yes, Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it routine, standard, normal for the compilation of all of this data to come in at the onset of the EIS? Or is it usually distributed as it's noted? It would seem to me that if we're waiting 4, 5, 6 years and having a cumulative assessment dropped on a department, they're going to be overwhelmed. And my concern is that they're given adequate opportunity for discovery in the process.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I would like to see this data flowing more or less concurrently with it as it's being collected, and that's not the case right now. And again, I think that's one of the issues to look at in the permitting process. That the regulatory agencies can't require that; they don't have the authority to require that. Sometimes mines will release that voluntarily. That's the only way you can get it. Mm-hmm. I just finished a review of an environmental assessment for a mine in Minnesota, and there was a huge amount of information available, and that was all being provided by the company to the agencies and through the agencies available to people like me and the public. But yeah, I agree with you, sir.
Yeah. Final comment.
Is there statute someplace in some state that provides for that opportunity so that if, in fact, we were going to institute some changes in our statute, we would be able to look at model legislation so that we could provide for that opportunity in the future?
Unfortunately, I'm not aware of any place that has that specific authority. I could research Minnesota and some other states who seem to do this sort of analysis a little more progressively, but I can't sit here and tell you that that's the legislative authority that they have.
Thank you. Dr. Chambers, I want to ask you a question on sulfide mines and the track record around the world for those sorts of mines. Obviously, in the U.S., and I imagine in other countries, they've been through pretty rigorous permitting processes. And what has been the track record of sulfide mines around the world in terms of meeting water and air quality standards, breaches, things of that nature after their completion?
As I mentioned, if you look at this class of mine, so again, the class of mine is a mine that has sulfidic ore in the ore body and is near water, groundwater and or surface water. In this case, it's both. And the record is pretty poor. About 75% of the time, they exceed their permit limits for water discharges. Now, again, keep in mind that when an agency issues a permit, it can't issue a permit that says you're going to exceed limits. That's never done. So to see that happen in that many cases is concerning.
And what would be the impact if to the environment, to the fishery, to the habitat, if there were to be such a breach in this area? Can you give us any sort of estimation?
I think it's really difficult to try to, it's if not impossible to quantify it, but I think ultimately it boils down to how much risk you want to take and what's at risk. And we know that there are, one, that this is a healthy fishery out there. In fact, this is the last healthy salmon fishery in North America, basically, the last big one. And that salmonids are very sensitive to metals in general and copper in particular. So again, I think there are some risks out there. You know, can I tell you that this mine's going to be a disaster? No, I can't. this mine may fall in that 25% that it's okay. I don't know that, but all I can do is more or less point out the risks and look at some of the batting averages, but I can't tell you what the batter's going to hit.
Senator Wagner.
A lot of people have talked to me about one of the biggest fears in their mind is a containment dam. And one of the things they don't understand totally is the fact that the whole volume behind that dam is not going to be water. And as a matter of fact, a low percentage of the, when you look at the height and everything, is water. It's water is a cap that covers it. How many of these projects are there currently in the world that are contained this way, or maybe you do or don't know? And if there are, how many have had a problem with one of these dams rupturing and the containment dam going up?
Tailings dams are very common. There are lots of them in most places in the world, not just many, most places in the world. There are different types of construction for tailings dam. The type of construction that they're proposing here is the best type, you know, the most fundamentally sound engineering-wise. The good news about a tailings dam is, as you've said, the tailings are largely solid behind there. The bad news is, unlike a water reservoir, if you start seeing problems with your dam, you just drain the reservoir. You've got to maintain this thing in perpetuity. So to my mind, that means that you've got to make very conservative consumptions, especially about earthquakes, because that's the thing that would tend to stress a dam most strongly. In terms of the problems with tailings dams and tailings dams failures, worldwide, there's a tailings dam failure on the average of once every 18 months. And if you read the literature from the experts in the field, they're very concerned about this. And again, I think fundamentally it has to do with assumptions that are made in designing these things, and quite frankly, constructing them has been another issue, in that you can have a perfectly designed dam, but unless your engineers build it to specifications, it can cause you problems, and that has caused failures too. Not so much in this country, but in developing countries.
And last question, Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much of this risk would be mitigated if the mine were not an open pit mine?
I personally have as much concern about the underground mine that's proposed as I do about the open pit, because in this case, in order to mine a low-grade ore body underground, you have to use a technique called block caving. And what that does is just structurally destroy the rock. That's basically how that method works. And so it's going to fracture not only the material it's mined, it's going to fracture rock all the way to the surface. So you're basically building an open pit from the bottom up and filling it with rubble. And we know this rubble contains sulfide minerals. The only difference between ore and waste is an economic one. It's not necessarily a mineralogical one. So then the hydrology becomes important, you know. All right, we know it's going to have water in it, it's going to have access to oxygen. Where is it going to go? And that's, I don't know the answer to that one.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chambers, or Dr. Chambers, thank you for your testimony. Okay, next up we have John Shively, CEO of Pebble Partnership. Mr. Shively, welcome to the committee. And if you could please put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is John Shively. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Pebble Limited Partnership. I'll try to go through the questions. Question one, I don't think I see the risks any differently than either Mr. Fogels or Dr. Chambers. I mean, it's clearly an issue of water quality first. I mean, we have to have a water handling system that works. We have to have a tailings facility that holds back the tailings and holds back the water that's in the tailings facility. and we have to manage other water around the prospect. So, I mean, and the real danger to the fish is water quality. And so that, I think that, that is the biggest challenge. And it's something, although Dr. Chambers has engineered our tailings facility for us, we aren't quite done with it yet. So it may be a little while before some of the questions that he raised are answered. Obviously, the prospect is a big prospect. We've never shied away from that. The issue is not how big the prospect is. The issue is how big a mine we're going to permit. And I've said, I think, a number of times publicly that although the current resource, probably you could mine for 80 to 100 years, it is not our intent to permit the entire resource. And assuming we ever get into the permitting process, you will not see us attempting to permit a mine that's 80 to 100 years long. It will probably be more in the range, and we're still working on this, of 25 to 40 years. And, you know, there certainly are lessons to be learned for other mines. There are lots of studies, some of which I think are appropriate, some of which are a little bit biased about what's happened with mines. But personally, you know, if you look at Red Dog, as Ed Fogel said, yeah, they're a much smaller mine, but their mineralization is 25%. So 25% of what they take out of the ground is potentially acid generating. We have a lot more ore, but our ore ranges in from like 0.2% to 2 to 3%, much different. So we don't have as much sulfide. But acid mine drainage is an issue. It's an issue we have to deal with. I mean, there's no question we have potentially acid generating rock. In terms of, you know, which part of the statutes you might look at if you had a study, again, I don't think I'll disagree with either the two previous speakers. I want to say a couple things. You know, this whole thing of permitting and what's going on with permitting and with resource development in the state is a much broader issue than Pebble. And I think one of the issues that people have had, as they've certainly, I think we saw it in the initiative process 2 years ago, was in attempting to go after Pebble, it's very hard to get a rifle shot at us. It's a shotgun, and you have to look at how you're affecting the rest of the economy. And you look at what's going on in the rest of the economy now, you look at the fact that it's very likely that Red Dog will be shut down this fall, putting 500 people out of work, over half of whom are Alaska Natives. Conoco just got turned down for CD5 because the two federal agencies want to make a park out of NPRA. You've got the permitting problems that Shell has faced. So I think if you want to study, not only do you need to study the statutes, you need to study the process, because there are things going on, whether Pebble ever is permitted or not, there are things going on in this economy that I think do not bode well for the future. So if you want to study, I would think that you'd, and as Ed said, it's both state and federal issues. Actually, the bigger permitting issues are mostly federal. And in terms of whom we might choose to do the study, I mean, the National Science Foundation is well-respected. Certainly, they would do a good job. There are others that would do a good job. I'm not going to try to second-guess that if the legislature wants to have a study and fund a study. But I also would say that it's important to really focus on what you want to study. I mean, some of the things I've seen basically would have the whole project studied, and yet we don't have a project to study. So I think it's important to focus on what you want done, and then to bring in the kind of people that are experts and have a look at it. I think many of you know, I'm a former commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. I do think the state has a strong permitting process. It's looked at, you know, independently on a regular basis, particularly by people like the Fraser Institute, and we have a strong permitting process in the state. Can you make it better? You can always make things better. I don't deny that. So, but again, I think it's important to focus on what you want, and that may take some work. So, with that, Mr. Chairman, I think I've covered all four questions.
Thank you, Mr. Shively. Questions? Representative Edwin.
Thanks for being here, John. We've had many conversations on this issue already. Yeah, and we'll have a few more.
Yes.
We will. On the issue of hydrology, in really understanding the complex subsurface and surface water flow patterns in the greater Bristol Bay region, as I think certainly you and I both know quite well, there's tributaries that feed off into the major salmon-producing areas of the great Bristol Bay salmon fishery, you know, $5 billion or so worth of value in the last 20 years. Just over a short few years' time, can your company really understand the relationships between those water flows, both under the ground and above the ground, to tell somebody in Oostuyahawk, for example, downriver, not, you know, immediately adjacent to the mine site itself, but downriver, that you'll be protected, you know, in a perpetuity? I mean, that's the question that I hear all the time from my constituents in the area.
Mr. Chairman, I think the answer to that is yes. Our water monitoring studies are very extensive. They don't go down to Oostuyahawk, but they do go well beyond the project itself. I think that information will be ready available. One of the reasons that we have not rushed into permitting is to make sure we have the appropriate information. We've already spent over $100 million, and actually a fair amount of that information is public. Unlike any other project I've seen in the state, we have published a bunch of the environmental work we've done. It's readily available on our website. Now, the problem with that information, of course, is that until we have a mine plan, it's hard to interpret what that information means. But I am confident, given the amount of work we do, and we work year-round, it's not just a summer camping project. We work in the winter, we work in the summer, and we will have the volume of information that's needed. Because what happens is, if there's a problem, the problem's going to take place at the mine, and you've got to get it close to the mine. You've got to deal with it there, not at Oostuyahawk.
I'll follow.
Yes, please.
You're getting somewhat close to the permitting process. You're in the pre-permitting process, as I understand things. And I always have to wonder, I hear publicly that the project is just a proposal at this point. We don't have a plan in place. There's no way to really know what the size of the mine is going to be, or its potential impacts, or the relationships between things below the ground and above the ground and so forth. But there's got to be a plan somewhere. I mean, the corporate boardroom in London, and with all the investors that are funding this project, have to know what they're getting into. And so to me, somewhere behind the veil between that wall, and we visit this issue all the time with industry, the oil industry or other industries that Alaska has got longstanding relationships with, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes and so on and so forth. But how close are you to the permitting process at this point?
Mr. Chairman, a couple things. I mean, we have ideas, we have concepts. There's not a plan sitting in London in Cynthia Carroll's office saying this is what the mine's going to look like. I'll guarantee you that, because we don't have it. There are lots of pieces to this puzzle. I mean, that's one of the problems. I mean, you've got the issues that you've raised about hydrology. You've got the issues of tailings dam design. You've got the issue of how you're going to deal with of holding the tailings where it is. You've got the economic issues of what kind of plant do you want. You've got the size of the mine. You've got an 82-mile road. You've got a port. You've got to figure out power. All these things, and they're interrelated. So if you have one size mine, let's say 100,000 tons a day, you're going to have one power need. If you're going to have an underground mine, the amount of power you're going to need is going to be substantially more. So, you know, I've heard people say before, well, you got to have this plan, and it's just a secret plan. Well, it's not. I mean, we don't. We have ideas, but it moves. Now, in terms of where we are in the permitting process, when I took this job almost 2 years ago now, in 2008, at that time, the partnership was saying we were going to be in the permitting process at the end of 2008. What we're saying now is we might be in the permitting process in sometime in early 2011, but it's not a date. I mean, we're not driven by a date to get into permitting. We're driven by trying to put a project together that meets the high environmental standards we know have to be met and is also economic.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things, Mr. Shively, you are going to do over the next year while you're developing your plan is transport fuel to drive some of the equipment you're using there at the mine. And recently there was a well-publicized spill of diesel on the way to the site. There's some question, I think, right now about the degree of responsibility that Pebble's going to assume for that fuel transport. Maybe you could comment on that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frentz, that was not our fuel spill, and that fuel actually wasn't necessarily designed for the project. That was designed, some of it might have gone to us, but they were also bringing fuel in to deliver to villages. This was a partner of ours in Iliamna Development Corporation that was transporting the fuel. They had this concept that if they brought fuel over the Pile Bay Road and brought it in by barge to communities around the lake, that they could substantially lower the cost of fuel, which they did. It was an unfortunate spill, and everybody agrees that. It was not a spill that was particularly environmentally damaging, but it was not our fuel that got spilled.
Follow-up?
Yes.
Maybe you can talk about the fuel that you are going to transport and how you and your project are going to ensure that it's transported in a safe and environmentally sensitive way.
Mr. Chairman, Senator French, if we have a mine or now?
Now.
Well, what happens now is fuel is brought into Iliamna for us by, it's been a series of different contractors. Right now, Iliamna Development Corporation, the local, a subsidiary of the local Native Corporation, is the one that's providing us fuel. They have a fuel storage area in Iliamna. The helicopters that we fly, you know, we don't have any permanent facilities out the site. We headquarter everybody in Iliamna. The helicopters are fueled there at that fueling facility. For fuel, that, for drilling rigs and things like that, it is flown out in a Beaver, I think, but a fixed wing plane to a fuel storage area we have at Wiggly Lake, and then that's flown in double-hauled containers to the drilling rigs and put in another container, and that's the main way we transport fuel.
And just one last question on this. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you ramp up operations there, how do you see your company's involvement in fuel transportation? And are you satisfied that you're prepared to do that in a way that you don't spill diesel into Lake Iliamna?
Mr. Chairman, Senator French, if you're looking at the long term in terms of the mine, most likely we will have assuming we use diesel for the equipment, that's still a decision we're looking at, it would probably be a pipeline that would go along the road that comes out of the port, and the road, I think, is far enough removed from Lake Iliamna. It won't be transported across Iliamna, Lake Iliamna.
And just one last, and how about during road construction? I mean, the road's going to have to be widened, it's going to have to be bigger before you can lay a pipeline there. I mean, there's just going to be a lot, I'm concerned because there's going to be a lot of work there with heavy equipment, and early in the process we've had a diesel spill, and I just, I don't know, at what level Pebble is going to step in and make sure that you're responsible for the handling of diesel in this very sensitive area, or if it's going to be done by subsidiaries and folks with whom you have sort of an arm's length transaction and less responsibility.
Well, I mean, we pay for it because we require that they have insurance so that there is a problem that's taken care of. We also review their safety. We have standards they have to meet in order to provide us fuel. So whether or not we're doing it ourselves or not, we try to make sure that it's done safely. That is part of our responsibility. Who's going to transport it or not, we just haven't made that decision.
Thank you.
Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to go back to Co-Chair Edgman's inquiry, if I might. First of all, thank you for making yourself available. It's important for this process. My concern, the concern that's been addressed and brought to me, was not that there's not information. The problem is when it's presented, if it's presented all at once, is that it will overwhelm an agency and they won't be able to address it in a timely manner. So if you could address that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, well, it is going to be a big project. And, you know, we will pay for the review. The review is going to be done by more than just state employees. They will bring in other people on contract. Generally, what happens in a project this big is, you know, other environmental consulting firms that actually do this work. and as will the federal government. There's a major EIS process that goes along with the state process. It is a lot of information. One of the reasons we didn't think it was all that great to release it in the way that Dr. Chambers suggested we did is because, first of all, it needs to be quality checked. And we have a separate process to make sure that the way the data was originally gathered met the quality standards that needs to be met. Then we need to put it in a manner, in a format that's readable, which we call the environmental baseline document. That document we're actually in the process of producing now. That document will have 53 chapters and certainly will be available to the public. My assumption is I get a little bit of this from my job as a former job as commissioner, that if there's too much information to review, either the state is going to ask for more money to get more people to review it, or they're going to ask for more time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Millett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for being here, and I appreciate your company's investment so far into that region. I think it's done a lot for their economy out there. I've been out there a couple times, and also I've fished for 20 years out in Bristol Bay, so I'm not more than other people, but I understand the dynamics of that fishery and understand what's at risk. And being a former DNR commissioner, I imagine that you understand the value of that resource and the value of that region. Is that something that you take into the boardroom, and does the public partnership understand what's at risk? I mean, is that something that you talk about? Because I can imagine that your company doesn't want to go forward with something that's going to forever stain the reputation of your mining company. So it's hard for me to believe that you would be going forward without those risks weighing very heavily on not only your reputation, but on the risk to, you know, the land and the what is at risk, I guess. And so could you just talk to me about what those conversations are like and the magnitude of that level of conversation rises to in your boardroom?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Millett, it's a big part of what we talk about and a big part of what's driving our engineering. And it's, of course, why not only did, you know, I took this job, and some people thought I was nuts to take it, but I took the job because I thought it needed an Alaska perspective, that there are certainly opportunities here, as people have talked about, but there's certainly risk. And I have lots of friends in Bristol Bay that I've worked with for 40 years, many of whom are opposed to this project, but I also have friends out there who see the potential economic advantages. We chat with it all about it all the time. Everybody realizes that this is about the fish, that if we cannot show that the fish will be protected, this project is going nowhere.
Thank you.
Great. And I just have one real quick question for you. What I've heard is that the power needs for this project are enormous, 400 megawatts, 500 megawatts, which is roughly half of the peak load in the entire rail belt. Is that true? And how do you expect to generate power in that area?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. It's a good question. And again, that relates to size, and we've been all over the place on that issue. Right now, our best guess is probably somewhere between 250 and 300 megawatts. And our choice is to have natural gas at site. We get a benefit if we generate power at site from the waste heat in terms of the processing. But of course, natural gas is not readily available. If you look at projects that are being talked about, either the spur line or the bullet line, both of which need industrial users to make the price of gas reasonable, unless there's going to be a large state subsidy, then we could be one of those projects that would help make those proposals economic. I would say in the short run, if we do use natural gas and there isn't a huge find in Cook Inlet, which actually I'm not expecting right away, the two most logical options are, one, it seems to me likely that sometime in the next several years, the LNG plant in Nikiski will shut down. That plant could be flipped to a receiving plant, and gas could be brought in not only for us, and then we'd ship the gas across the inlet. The other option for us, if we're going to look at using LNG, is they now have technology that where the LNG barges have regasification capacity right on the barge, so we could bring that right into our dock facility, and that also could be a source potentially of energy for vehicles. We haven't looked at that. The other thing about energy that we've talked about is that we get energy, reasonably priced energy, to the mine, then we really want to cooperate with the state with taking that energy to the western part of that region, which I think would have some benefit for the state because of the power cost equalization program.
Mr. Shively, thank you for coming and testifying before us. Appreciate it. Okay, and last up, we have former Senate President Rick Alford. And welcome to the committee. And if you could please put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I very much appreciate your time this Friday afternoon. It's great to see this many people. Of course, the first question I always get on this topic is, why would somebody who has been a mining advocate all their life be on the wrong side of all their old friends on this issue? And in some ways, that's a difficult question. But it really says, what is different about this than all the others that I'd ever dealt with, flown for, advocated for, or worked on legislation for? It was at the request of people in Bristol Bay that I got involved in this, and I've been working with them now for the last couple of years. I was last on the site about 5 days ago. Actually, not on the site. I was overflying and looking to see just what activity was there on the way back from a few days in Dillingham with my family. I've been on the site walking around, taking a lot of pictures, looked at a lot of the land there, and it is an incredible area. It's, I can't think of a place that would be more challenging to try to develop a sulfide mine. And if there's a test coming from above for us all, it's looking at this one, because it does have incredible value and incredible risks. It's in a saddle at somewhere close to 1,000 feet, and the deposit goes to something probably as deep as 3,000 feet below sea level by the drilling data that I've seen. I think the comment made by Mr. Shively that you don't want to negatively impact all the other mines in Alaska by what you do with regard to Bristol Bay is a good one, and it's one that I certainly agree with. And I think it's also one that if you look at a study, I think you look at a study specific to this project, you look at the area of this project and the risks and benefits of this project, and I hope you do it very broadly. But we've seen the data first from Northern Dynasty, and it hasn't changed except to increase from the Pebble Partnership. I wonder, could we get these slides to go? Just to give you an idea of the area, we just got a few, and it's not a PowerPoint, just what the area looks like.
Up and down.
Right, up and down, right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty good.
Okay. Obviously, technology's way ahead of me.
Must be winter out there.
My cell phone.
It's nighttime.
I am, so. Yeah. Go ahead, push that one. Let's start to Seattle.
We're going to get some technical assistance.
Anyway, the things that are different about this, in terms of just simply, its size, type, and location, and you can categorize everything into those categories. That's my 185 sitting on Frying Pan Lake, which I think is absolute ground zero by the Northern Dynasty plans. That would be about 700 feet under tailings in their plan. That is a lake that has a significant fish population in it, and it's certainly a beautiful area. But the things that we can quantify the most easily, now I'm going to try and push a button here and see if it does any good. I don't know if it does. Oh, yes, that's a good one. But it's gone. Okay, that's looking from the Cook Inlet side. That's looking from Cook Inlet side toward the Pyle Bay end of the Pyle Bay Road. And when John talks about an 82-mile road,
He's not counting the rebuilding that would take. The real transportation route is about 100 miles long, because this road is far from a road that you could haul the kind of stuff that they want to haul on it. I've got a couple of pictures of that, if this will work.
And I'll just...
This is looking the other way. This is from the same location looking back toward Williamsport. So at the that's Cook Inlet in the foreground there, and that's Williamsport, which is a barge landing that goes dry. And the next picture should tell you what the road looks like. That is a piece of the road about 3 miles from Williamsport toward Pyle Bay. And the reason they will only take boats up to 14 feet wide through there is because the gunnels drag on the rocks to the left as the rocks fall off to the right of the dual wheels down the hill about 500 feet. So there's certainly a lot to be done in that process. But I think it's important to recognize that, and I'm going to skip ahead a couple here, it's amazing technology. But it's important to recognize the size of this project relative to other things that we deal with, because that really lays out. I'm not pushing any buttons. I don't.
Yeah, and I'll just it's going to take us too long, I think, to try to fix it. So let's just try to power on.
Okay, you've got a hard copy of that. But the bottom line is the size of this project is really beyond imagination, and the only way that I can think of to understand something about size is to think of Greens Creek is a little teeny piece over in the corner, and to look at Fort Knox is obviously the biggest thing there, and Donlin is in the Fort Knox class. I mean, even if you add the largest mine in North America, you only fill that hole about one-third full. So the level of review should be commensurate with the size of the transaction, and that's what this is, the transaction, the risk of the transaction, and the duration of the transaction. And in this case, the size is astronomical, the risk is very, very high, and the term is forever. That's why I think it's appropriate for you as a legislative body to have absolutely as much information as you can. If you look at what we spent on everything from Sousette and the Dam to the Kinnick Arm Crossing to the gas line, we spend millions and millions of dollars to review important projects. And you do it both in the executive branch and in the legislative branch, and I think you should. I think the review by the National Research Council, the National Academy, is just one piece of what you should be doing. I think you should be going back to the commissioners of DNR, Fish and Game, and DEC, and asking them for a capital project to beef up their information gathering ability, so you don't have bought and paid for science driving the whole process. And it doesn't mean that all that science is bad. I appreciate the amount of money that's gone into that area as well. And I think it's important to balance the process, but the process can go on forever. It's been extended two or three times now, and the people of Bristol Bay have dealt with the cloud on their product, on their livelihood, on their future, and the rest of the mining industry, although they don't come forward and say so, the rest of the mining industry probably has a little more trouble getting money for other projects. They probably worry about tax issues. They probably worry about other things. This is not aimed at the rest of the mining industry. And what you do, hopefully, with this is going to be very specific to Bristol Bay. And it is not intended either in the department to change their standards. Again, size is overwhelming. Type of ore body is very dangerous. And it's not just whether the dam goes out. This is a powder. This is a high wind area. There's a lot of ways it can spread and end up back in the water column through rains that aren't just a major dam failure, just drying out in the strange year that you might have one in 50. But a perpetual project is important. Another factor that I'd like to just point out is, I don't think any of us would assume that a multinational company is going to mine any less than all the mineable ore by their estimates. They may make an application for half of that or a quarter of that, but we should recognize that the project size and scope should be driven by what's there to be mined. And we should recognize that size and that scope and that amount. And that is also part of what drives us. We don't have a plan, but we have a lot of things to talk about project description. We know the material, their drill logs, the type of material, the fact that all the other things that are in there that are beneficial are way outweighed by the amount of sulfur, which is potentially damaging in that same ore body. We know the depths, the composition. It's a very, very low-grade ore with a pretty significant amount of sulfur in it. It's 100 miles away. All those things have to be elements of a mine plan. It's got to be a bulk mining method, whether it's block caving that caves to an open pit or whether it's open pit from the start, it's going to be a bulk mining method. And sadly for those who advocate for it, it hasn't, as a low-grade, high-volume operation, it hasn't got the financial capacity to possibly carry some of the environmental things that may be necessary in this area. So I'm sorry that I did jump around on your questions. I apologize, but I would encourage you to look at the Academy, but also look at the rest of your authority as a separate branch of government to get as much information as you possibly can and to empower the administration with the funding. I mean, I think the DNR representative pointed out his qualifier was assuming adequate resources. And he talked about a flexible process. This is a process that in this case should be flexed to its maximum protection, and that is not going to be without cost. But the resources are infinitely valuable and certainly should be protected. I'd be glad to try to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, Senator Halford. Questions? Yes, Representative Edgman.
In terms of comparing the Pebble mine to other existing mines, there was a conversation at the Board of Fisheries this past December. I think one of the board members asked you about the Red Dog mine. And I think for the context of the purpose of this hearing, which is to, certainly from my point of view, to advocate for the National Research Council to come in and take an independent look at the whole process and the project itself. But I think to sort of put the context properly in place, looking back at the formation of the large mining team back in the late 80s, ostensibly to help with the Red Dog permitting process, Mr. Shively was directly involved with it, so on and so forth. But how different, or maybe talk about the similarities and the differences between the Red Dog mine, which a successful mine provided a lot of income, a lot of jobs at the area, a project I certainly support, but with the proposed Pebble project mine, if you could speak a little bit to that.
I think in summary, the Pebble project is probably the opposite in almost everything I can think of from the Red Dog. Starting the Red Dog deposit, because it was very rich and of basically toxic elements, had already, just in prospecting or in natural erosion, significantly hampered the water quality in this area. There were very few conflicting resources. The Red Dog project, again, is incredibly rich. Again, 1% probably average in Pebble, you're looking at 20% zinc and 5% lead. I mean, an incredibly, incredibly rich resource. It was also on native land, and the 7i provisions of the lands plans provide that shares through all the native corporations all across the state. It also provides the benefit that by contract, you can have local hire provisions that we can't constitutionally enforce in the state. Again, the resource that was endangered by the development of the project was very, very minimal. For all of those reasons, it's been overwhelmingly publicly supported by the people of the area. And that's the bottom line that is very, very different, because the opposite conditions in Bristol Bay have resulted in overwhelming public opposition to this project in Bristol Bay. And to say that you shouldn't decide because you haven't got a plan, when you know the size, the location, the ore type, and that you have to have a bulk mining method, it begs the question. And if I were an advocate for this project, I would probably never present a plan until I had the votes and had worked through the process as much as I possibly could and could get it approved. So we may never see a plan from this project. And for the time that we wait, we endanger the resources in conflict, in reputation, and the people of Western Alaska, and we endanger the advocates for every other mining project that is threatened either in its financing or in its perception.
Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your comments, you mentioned the tremors sent through the industry. You broached the subject of taxes. This in consideration that of all of the mines we've talked about today, or are in consideration, this mine is entirely on state land.
Yes, it is.
I'd like to hear what you have to say about what you've touched on.
As somebody who generally likes the mining industry and supports the mining industry, I would say that most of the mines in Alaska can't carry anywhere near the taxes that the oil industry can carry or a lot of other things can carry. There's always an argument about what you're talking about when you talk about a percentage tax. And if you look at the negotiations that we see between native corporations and mineral interests, they agree to some pretty reasonably high royalties that you wouldn't expect. But as I understand it, the profits-based tax, which is a very small percentage of a net smelter royalty tax that this project would generate if not changed, is somewhere in the range of 1 or 1.5%. So it's a very low rate of return. And it doesn't mean it's a low rate of return in terms of economic activity or spin-off or local taxes or property taxes or something else. But I think I just read something where another one of the big mines just negotiated an 8% net smelter royalty with the private owner of the property. That is probably five times as much as because again, one is based on profit after all expenses are taken out. That's the state system, and the systems used in other places that are more aggressive in gathering either a private owner share or a state share generally use net smelter royalty.
Senator French.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Senator Halford, you spent a fair amount of time sitting on this side of the table. If you were on this side of the table, what would you do?
I think, in all honesty, from both sides of this question, it makes sense to get more information. And that's something the legislature's good at. And I would go to every source you can. I would go, and again, it's difficult because a lot of the contractors you want to go to in a specialized area, you get their next job from the opposite side of the table. And one of the reasons the state defends its right to tax is, and not tie down its tax, is because we often do a lousy job in the ownership side of protecting our resource values. But the other side is very, very well armed. They're very well paid, they're very well educated, they have lifelong careers for the companies they work for. And our side is elected and appointed people who have to hire experts from their side of the table, usually. It's a very difficult equation. I would gather all the information you possibly could, and I wouldn't wait for somebody to bring you science that they've bought and paid for.
Thank you.
That's part of the reason we're having this hearing. Senator Wagner.
Thank you for being here, Rick. Worst case scenario, what percentage of the Iliamna fishery could be affected?
Worst
case scenario.
Great question, and there's lots of different potential effects. The Iliamna fishery is probably, one-third of the entire fishery. It's one of the five major drainages. The problem with this saddle, of course, is it gets two of them. It gets the Nooshigak and the Kwijak and Iliamna Lake. But even in the development phase, if, for example, you, and this comes back to the liability question, if you had a sectional tanker with four vehicles that had come across, four trailers that had come across the road, 10,000 gallons in each one of them, and you lost it in the middle of Lake Iliamna in water too deep for recovery, which there is, you could have four tankers bubbling for years as they corroded and finally failed. If one of them were full of a separation chemical that's far worse than petroleum products, or even lubricating oil, it would make it even worse. That is, again, these numbers are beyond my comprehension, but that actually is one of the worst examples I can think of, and that's an example that could happen during building the road, the very first major piece of the project. I don't know the answer.
I wondered about that. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, thank you, Senator Helfrich.
Thank you.
Okay, and that wraps up our testimony. Are there closing comments by committee members? Representative Edgman, do you have anything you want to say?
Well, I'd like to thank both the Senate Committee and certainly the Fisheries Committee, which I chair on the House side, for devoting a good part of their Friday afternoon. We're now past 5 o'clock, and I really appreciate all the good questions and certainly the participants themselves coming forward. And the pebble issue has been said many times, obviously very controversial. It's going to be here for a while. It's not going to be an issue that just suddenly goes away with the any sort of small decision made on, I think, either side of whether it be the government side or certainly the developer side. It's an issue that, for me personally, I've got constituents who are on both sides of this issue. But I also have, again, survey after survey showing that the majority of the constituents out there are extremely worried about this project. And, in terms of a public policy question for us to consider, I think it is necessary to go forward with the independent third-party review of this project. For all the above reasons stated, this project is very different in size. It's very different in its proximity. You could look at any other sort of development project in Alaska, most of which receive the majority of support from Alaskans throughout the state, by the way, and we are a resource development state, but that this project is really, it is the perfect storm of having a renewable project right next to a non-renewable project with a great many unknowns that are not quantifiable, that are not, are just hard to know. And if you look at, Mr. Chairman, all the fisheries all along the West Coast, all throughout the Fraser River in Canada, we're the last great salmon fishery. And again, as a public policy question, wouldn't we go the extra mile to devote extra resources to studying this thing? And as Mr. Fogle said, do we have enough resources not only to permit the doggone thing, but also to monitor it? And also, do we have the liability protections in place once we get the mine built and once it's in place, existing well into perpetuity? So for me, I'm no expert on mining at all, but I've learned a lot in the last several years, some by leading with my chin, by the way, through introducing of legislation. But I've learned enough to ask a lot more questions and to be unsatisfied with the qualified responses that I receive or with the promises of protection and no net loss and so forth. I'd close by saying that I think that the legislature needs to pursue this study. I think we need to support the Department of Natural Resources. I think we need to support the developer and their efforts. And we also, first and foremost, need to develop the Alaskans that live out there, Mr. Chairman, because they're the ones that are going to be directly impacted, whether it's those receiving the economic benefits in and around the mine as the mine's in the exploration stage, or whether it's those further on down the river who just feel the risk. They don't necessarily get the economic benefit and may never see any economic benefit from it down the road as well. So with that, I thank you for the hearing, and I look forward to future conversations on the issue.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. Senator Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First place, I want to qualify. I've been a commercial fisherman in Cook Inlet. We have 16 platforms produce oil in Cook Inlet. Never had a major spill from any of those platforms. Biggest spill we had was a bad captain that ran into a rock. We had our little oil spill in Cook Inlet. I ran my boat right through it, middle of fishing season. So let's don't sell the salmon short either, folks, because they're a pretty tough creature. And I am in favor of pursuing the mine, but I think we need to do it very safely, in the safest way possible, because there are a lot of people that depend on the fishery for their livelihood. We aren't quite like that in Cook Inlet anymore. We're kind of an endangered species in Cook Inlet. But Bristol Bay is the last bastion where a man can make a living fishing. So we do need to protect that. We also need to look for other sources of jobs because we aren't going to be pumping oil forever. And there are a lot of Alaskans that are going to need work. So it's something we got to weigh, and I think we should pursue it, but I think we need to be very, very careful with it at the same time.
Other comments? Okay, and I'll just close by saying, thanking everyone on the committees for staying a little bit late, and thanking everyone who came out and testified. I don't think we can have enough information. I often am bothered by the fact that we make decisions all the time here, and feeling that we don't have as much information as I would like. I think this is one of those situations where we really can't afford to be wrong. And the more information we get, the better. From my perspective, I would certainly support additional information, research from in-state and from out-of-state. I think an independent, unbiased group like the National Academy of Sciences would probably be a good thing for all parties concerned to look at this, just to ensure that our statutes, rules, regulations are up to par, are as good and as strong, and will protect the fishery and the habitat as we can possibly get. So with that, we'll adjourn, and I'm sure the discussion will continue.